From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Will today's story be Big Brown Best or Breakdown or both? Ahead on Only a Game, a look ahead to today's Preakness. Also, the latest NBA playoff action, a WNBA season preview, and a conversation with Sarah Freely, author of a new collection of baseball poems titled Sort of Gone. Also ahead, Team Slipstream goes into the cycling season claiming its extreme testing program proves it's competing cleanly.
Cycling needs to take extreme measures to prove that it can rebuild credibility, because right now it doesn't have any. It's not a matter of we need to maintain our credibility or guard our credibility. No, it doesn't have any. It's starting from scratch.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. 2 weeks ago, Big Brown won the Kentucky Derby. For a lot of people paying attention to the spectacle, that was the second biggest story at Churchill Downs that day, the first being the breakdown and euthanizing of Eight Bells, the horse that finished second in the race. Today at Pimlico in Baltimore, Big Brown will attempt to win the Preakness, the second jewel of racing's Triple Crown. Obviously, the fate of Eight Bells will be on the minds of a lot of the people involved in the race and the people watching it as well. Joining me now to look back at the Derby and ahead to the Preakness is Jenny Reese of the Louisville Courier-Journal. Jenny, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Bill.
Let's start with that look back at the Derby. People watching the race on TV had a surreal and disquieting experience as they were jerked from images of the people associated with Big Brown celebrating to the images of track ambulances blocking the view of Eight Bells. What did it feel like at Churchill Downs after the Derby?
Surreal is an excellent word. Watching it outside the press box in person, you see this tremendous race by Big Brown, and then you realize that's a filly that's second, and they're galloping out, and they're galloping out fine, and you look to see who's third, which was Dennis of Cork. The next thing you know, you look on the first turn, and you see this horse that just dropped. I thought she had had maybe heat exhaustion, even though the temperatures were not really hot. Something very bizarre is, as Larry Jones, her trainer, would say later when he courageously came up to the press box to address the media, he said it's not part of the game because this just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And people that had been in the business a long time said they'd never seen a horse who was so close to being pulled up just go down like that with those horrific injuries to both front legs.
William Knack, with whom I spoke last week, maintains that some of the horses running today have been bred with insufficient regard for leg strength. They're fast, but they're fragile. Are there specific horses in the Preakness about whom people might be worried?
I think racing's going to be collectively holding their breath to make sure they all get across the finish line safely. As far as specific sire lines or breeding lines in these horses, no. I just think it's been kind of an erosion of the breed. The market forces are such that people breed and they buy horses for brilliance and for speed, and maybe way in the back of their mind they're thinking about resilience and durability, but that's not what sells. There's a horse in the races, a perfect example of this today, named Tres Borrachos, which means three drunks in Spanish.
Mm-hmm. The owners
named them for
themselves.
That
one. Right.
And they call it their beer money horse. But anyways, the owner and co-breeder, John Greeley, he bought this mare, Pete's Fancy, who had raced 40 times. Deliberately, he bought her so he could breed her to his stallion, Ecton Park, who raced 23 times. He said he wanted to breed soundness to soundness. Takes him to the yearling sale and buys a horse back for $7,000, which is just nickel and dime stuff for buying yearlings. Nobody wanted to buy the horse, so they kept the horse. They gave half interest in the horse to John's brother, Bo, to train the horse, and here they are in the Preakness Stakes. So I think that's kind of a telling vignette of, you know, what's going on. Soundness doesn't necessarily sell as well as the real classy, chic bloodlines and speed.
Eddie Placa Jr., who trains Heyburn, Heybyrn, said the horse's owner, Mrs. Beatrice Oxenberg, entered Heyburn in the Preakness because, quote, she wanted to come and taste the crab cakes. Besides Big Brown, Gallego is the only Derby horse entered in the Preakness. Don't the owners of the other Derby horses like crab cakes?
Yeah, I think they like crab cakes. I think they don't like Big Brown. And when it came to that, it's like maybe if it was 3 weeks between races or 4 weeks, they'd say they'd get another crack at him. But it is kind of stunning that only one other horse has opted to come back in 2 weeks. And maybe it's also an acceptance by the people that have these horses that they're just cut below.
All these horses are second best.
They're all second best, but I tell you what, yesterday that Ken DeZormo was up in the press box talking, and he knows very well how horses can get beat that mm-hmm. look unbeatable. He won the 2000 Derby on Fusciacci Pegasus, and he said, this was in his cockier days, that he didn't see how the horse could get beat at Pimlico. And he finished second to Red Bullet.
Mm-hmm.
And he also was riding Real Quiet, the Derby and Preakness winner in 1998. And he said at the top of the stretch of the Belmont, he says, I know what it feels like to win a Triple Crown because I thought I was the winner. And then, bam, on the last stride of the race, he gets beat by Victory Gallop. So strange things can happen, and, of course, that's why they have betting.
Racing fans who never bet favorites may want to take a look at Ichabod Crane. This horse is comfortable in Baltimore. He won the Federico Tessio Stakes at Pimlico less than a month ago. But how much does familiarity with the course matter?
I don't think it really matters. I think it's familiarity with winning big races is what matters. But Ichabod Crane has one thing going for him, especially for a 30-1 shot. Besides Big Brown, he's the only horse in the field who is unbeaten on real dirt. His one defeat coming on the Poly track at Turfway Park.
A lot of people, probably the great majority of racing fans, will be rooting for Big Brown, since that will mean a potential Triple Crown winner, and everybody gets excited about that. But I wonder how many people watching today's race will be rooting even harder for an injury-free trip.
I think everybody will be. That's what they'll be rooting the hardest for. But among the biggest rooters for Big Brown, I must say, are the connections of the filly Eight Bells. She was the one that was closest to Big Brown, and if he goes on, it makes her in her memory look all the better.
Jenny, by next May, I will be claiming that you picked the winner in the Kentucky Derby. It's just what I do. So shake off the Colonel John fantasy and tell us which horse wins today in Baltimore.
Well, I got spanked, didn't I, in the Derby? So
not
maybe
by me.
Go very safe, and I will go with Big Brown, which probably means somebody like Kentucky Bear is going to win the Preakness.
Jenny Reese writes about thoroughbred racing for the Louisville Courier-Journal and joins me at this time each year on Only a Game. Thank you, Jenny.
Sure, Bill.
Team Slipstream Chipotle won last Saturday's time trials in Stage 1 of cycling's Giro d'Italia. Slipstream rider Magnus Backstead came in ninth during Thursday's Stage 4. The Colorado-based team claims its 2008 success has been cleanly earned, citing the use of what it says is cycling's most rigorous testing regimen. But will Slipstream's example be enough to help reestablish trust in one of Europe's most popular but tarnished sports? Nancy Greenlease reports.
At the Giro d'Italia, Team Slipstream is on a roll. They credit their preparation. They've sweated and shivered up and down mountains on at least two continents. They've eaten way too many energy bars. And they've answered their email.
It's a BlackBerry. It's a small little plastic thing with a screen and some buttons on it.
Cyclist Jason Donald fingers the dark blue wireless device that all the team's riders must carry. Without warning, the 28-year-old Coloradan will get an alert to put the brakes on what he's doing to give up some bodily fluids.
It's just a way for them to get in touch with us. And, you know, who knows? It could be embedded with the GPS unit and they know where we are all the time, kind of like Big Brother, but I'm not really sure and it doesn't bother me all that much.
On demand, he's trekked to a lab once a week to give blood and urine samples. That's in addition to tests required by race and international authorities. But the bloodletting is a small sacrifice, says Donald, who used to work as a garbage collector to finance his pro cycling dreams.
This team is something special and this team is something different because there isn't any pressure to take drugs.
Team Slipstream rider Will Frischkorn cycles back to his Boulder, Colorado home after spending the morning cycling up the Rocky Mountains. He ducks into the garage and yanks off his cycling shoes. The West Virginia native says he's never even considered using drugs. He says many of his peers have been forced to dope to improve and keep their contracts.
It's funny, I sometimes joke. I mean, if I were a guy coming out of an Eastern Bloc country and I were going to work in a coal mine versus ride a bike, and I was probably going to die at 50 there. And if I were to ride a bike and maybe take a few chances medically, I could bring my entire family and live on the coast of Spain. I mean, can you see how someone like that might rationalize it? Yeah.
A few years ago, Liberty Mutual's team hired former pro cyclist Jonathan Vauders to do a study on how to build a winning team that didn't force its cyclists to use drugs. A doping scandal destroyed the team before the plan was implemented, so Vauders applied it to his own Colorado-based team.
Cycling needs to take extreme measures to prove that it can rebuild credibility, because right now it doesn't have any. It's not a matter of we need to maintain our credibility or guard our credibility. No, no, it doesn't have any. It's starting from scratch.
Vauders was a member of Lance Armstrong's U.S. Postal Service team that helped him win the 1999 Tour de France. He says doping was prevalent in the 90s, and too many riders, then and now, face a difficult dilemma.
The decision is, you know, lose your dream that you've worked for since you were 13 years old. Forget about that because you're going to be deemed non-competitive, or completely scrap your moral and ethical grounding.
Vauders won't directly answer to whether he used or not. He says he doesn't want the past to distract from what the team is trying to accomplish now.
You know, I don't have any fear of what my past was, but at the same token, it's not something that I really want to talk about. I mean, if anyone wants to come to me and, you know, have dinner with me and a bottle of wine, I'll tell them all the details.
But, Vauders adds, his current riders must reveal all during their frequent laboratory visits. The Agency for Cycling Ethics, or ACE, oversees testing for fluctuations in cyclists' biological markers, rather than for the abuse of specific drugs. Riders with questionable results are pulled from competition for further testing, but some question whether even the labs are trustworthy. Cyclists, including Lance Armstrong, have accused labs of mishandling samples, but Jim Winnett of ACE says his agency has everything to lose by fudging results.
Just like big public accounting firms, while it's true that we're paid by the sponsors and the teams to bring these services on, we're putting our stamp on them, and it's our reputation at stake.
Slipstream is forking over about $400,000 annually for the testing, which seems like overkill when the International Cycling Union, or UCI, already tests athletes. But the former president of the World Anti-Doping Agency, Dick Pound, says Slipstream's methods could help raise the bar across the entire cycling world.
Initiatives of this nature will bring it home to the UCI and its national federations that they are not doing enough to satisfy either the riders who are being forced to dope or the public, which is witnessing a sport that's not clean.
UCI has followed Slipstream's lead and is now taking baseline measurements of athletes to better track abnormalities. Yet Pound contends the sport still has a long and bumpy road ahead to get fans and sponsors back.
Do I have faith? I don't have faith yet. I certainly have hope that it will happen, but it's going to take a complete paradigm shift in the attitude towards doping, the people who are already embedded in the sport, the coaches and everybody to turn it around.
Slipstream's riders say they're getting the sport back on track, but their real test is underway now at the Giro d'Italia as they attempt to show fans that cyclists can ride fast and clean. For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenless in Denver.
I ride in your slipstream, away. Reflection, I echo your heartbeat in the wind.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. There were probably lots of ways for the organizers of the Turkish Grand Prix to promote their auto race, arranging for McLaren team driver Lewis Hamilton to participate in a reenactment of the Siege of Troy was perhaps not the most divine among them. Following Hamilton's appearance as the Greek god Apollo in said production, the Times of London opined, "In the pantheon of ridiculous publicity stunts, it may rate among the greatest." The review went on to say that in his racing suit, Hamilton looked less like a majestic Apollo than a cross between Peter Pan and an astronaut. "I was just trying to get myself into the acting zone," Hamilton said. To his credit, he also said, "Let's forget about it." I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce goes one-on-one with the week's news and schools it. But first, in Game 6 of their NBA second-round playoff series with the Utah Jazz, the Los Angeles Lakers did the unthinkable. They won on the road. The final score was Lakers 108, Jazz 105, and Kobe Bryant led the Los Angeles Lakers with 34 points. The Lakers win that series 4-2. In Cleveland last night, the Boston Celtics followed this year's postseason script. The Cavaliers, capitalizing on the home court advantage, beat Boston 74-69. LeBron James had 32 points and 12 rebounds in that game. The two teams will meet in Game 7 of that series in Boston tomorrow. On Thursday night, the San Antonio Spurs evened their second-round series with the New Orleans Hornets at 3 games apiece. Game 7 is Monday. The Detroit Pistons have advanced to the Eastern Conference Finals and await the winner of the Cleveland-Boston series. And today, in arenas around the country, the WNBA season gets underway. Here to preview that season is Clay Callum of Full Court Press. Clay, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks, Bill. It's always good to be on.
The defending champion Phoenix Mercury have a new coach, and one of their key players from last season, Penny Taylor, is with the Australian national team, at least through the Olympics. Does this bode ill for Phoenix?
Yes, in a word. Taylor more so, Penny Taylor more so than Corey Gaines, who was Paul Westhead's assistant before moving up to take over the head job. Taylor is just a wonderful, wonderful player, very underrated, even overshadowed on the Mercury roster by Diana Taurasi. Even though Taylor might be the better player, she was the most valuable player in the World Championships in 2006.
The Los Angeles Sparks have regained the services of Lisa Leslie. She missed the 2007 season for the best of reasons. She was on maternity leave. They drafted Tennessee star Candace Parker, who led the Vols to this year's NCAA title. This would seem to be an intriguing duo.
Three words, worst to first. I think it's really going to be good for Candace Parker because when Lisa Leslie came out of college, she was not known as the hardest worker, but over her career, she has improved steadily throughout, which is a trait not usually found in professional athletes, but she has gotten better and better in all aspects of her game as time has gone on. Parker treats defense as a nasty communicable disease. So it's hoped that Leslie's influence may inspire Parker to see that, yes, it's worth putting in the time and energy to improve your game and work on your weaknesses rather than just being a great scorer. And Parker is a great scorer, and she's a great player. But she could do more. I think that even she would admit that during her Tennessee career, she probably could have done more on the defensive end and as a rebounder.
Which of the other five Western Conference teams do you feel will bear watching in 2008?
I really thought the San Antonio Silver Stars were going to be very good until Shanna Crossley tore her ACL earlier this week. Shanna is a tremendous outside shooter. She was Shanna Zolman when she was at Tennessee. And she was a key element for them because she gave them another three-point threat. They have Ann Waters, who came over from Belgium, who's been in the league before, but it's one of the top centers in the world. Aaron Buescher up front, Ruth Riley, Becky Hammond, who may play for the Russian Olympic team, all sorts of talent everywhere. I thought they might win it all before Crossley got hurt.
The Detroit Shock barely missed repeating as champions last season. Now their best players are back, along with some key offseason additions. Do they have enough to make it back to the finals this year?
All depends on Cheryl Ford's knee. She had what Bill Laimbeer told me was partial microfracture surgery. And
yuck.
Supposedly she is back and will be able to play at full strength. If so, she is absolutely the key because one half of the two-headed post tandem, Katie Feenstra and Kara Braxton, was lost in the expansion draft. So now Bill Laimbeer has to rely on the wildly erratic Kara Braxton at center. And if Ford isn't there to get rebounds every night, Detroit may not be as strong up front as they used to be because also Swin Cash is gone.
To what extent is the Indiana Fever's fortune tied to Tamika Catching's Achilles tendon?
Oh, about 100%.
These are easy questions for you, aren't they?
Simple. I mean, keep them coming. If she's 100% and she's playing well, they may be the best team in the East, maybe the best team in the league, but she's not, and until she is, they aren't.
Are there any Eastern Conference dark horses that we ought to be talking about at this point?
It's conceivable New York could build on what happened last year. They played very well down the stretch, had some nice moments. Again, it's a knee. Lauren Moore, if her knee is healthy and she's able to play it at top efficiency, then the Liberty could be quite good. Chicago has added Sylvia Fowles to a young team. So they have Candice Dupree and Sylvia Fowles and Chastity Melvin up front. And if Armenti Price can learn to shoot outside 5 feet, they will be... They could do some serious damage, but I think in the East, really, it's going to come down to Detroit and Indiana. The way the season works with the Olympic break, a lot of players are going to have time to heal. Tamika Catchings among them.
Mm-hmm.
And the second half of the season after the Olympics really is going to tell the tale, because that's just going to – that will allow teams that maybe have been struggling to get into the playoffs, and once in the playoffs with the best 2 out of 3 – really, the home court advantage isn't going to mean what it's been meaning in the NBA playoffs, let's put it that way.
Because the WNBA plays during the summer, they have had to break action for the Olympics a couple of times. Is this a good thing? Do the Olympics focus attention on pro basketball for women in this country, or does the break simply stop the momentum and cause people to stop thinking about the WNBA?
I think it's more of the latter. I think the break really hurts the league. Traditionally, their best attendance is in August, and that's when the Olympics are occurring this year. Now, sometimes they've been later. Sometimes the Olympics have been as late as in late September, and that hasn't hurt as much. But, yes, it's just one of those things that there's nothing the league can do about it. They are committed to the summer. The summer works really well for the league in so many other ways that the every 4 years conflict with the Olympics is just one of those things that can't be avoided.
The Atlanta Dream begins play today. Will Atlanta suffer through a typically nightmarish inaugural season?
Boy, the puns are everywhere on that one. Yes.
As in nightmare?
Another word. Another simple answer. They're going to struggle big time.
This is the WNBA's 12th season, Clay, and I've been paying some attention to the current ad campaign, which features the following quotes from WNBA players. Tamika Catchings, women's basketball is a joke. Cheryl Ford, I'm afraid of contact. Candace Parker, you couldn't pay me to watch women's basketball. This strikes me as an oddly defensive and aggressive at the same time campaign. What do you think?
The WNBA, on a serious note, has always struggled to find the right marketing tone. They have a really difficult challenge in that there are two primary groups of fans that go to games in the arenas, and that's where their money is made, are really from opposite ends of the spectrum. One group is gays and lesbians. The other group is families with young daughters. And somehow they have to craft a marketing campaign that will somehow appeal to both of those groups and at the same time attract casual fans to watch on TV.
I should explain regarding this marketing campaign that I saw it on the WNBA's website, and the idea is they put up these things that the players have allegedly said and then say, they wouldn't say this, would you?
Well, I certainly wouldn't say it to Cheryl Ford's face, let me tell you.
Clay Callum writes about women's basketball for Full Court Press. Clay, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Oh, always a pleasure, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Those who can, do. Those who can't, teach. That's how the saying goes. But that's only partially true, as reporter Beverly Amsler recently learned when she tracked down a martial arts instructor whose personal limitations are no limit when it comes to sharing knowledge with his students.
Okay, now full speed. Ready, one.
Kia!
Ready, two.
Kia!
Ready, three.
Kia!
Ready, four.
Kia!
If you close your eyes and listen, it sounds like an ordinary karate class. Lots of punching, kicking, and ki-eyeing. The sensei is encouraging students and making corrections. Now open your eyes, and you'll see the man leading the class, which is located in a former convenience store, is in a wheelchair.
Ready?
Kia!
Ready, go.
Kia!
All right, ready, go.
Kia!
Clay Johnson is a fourth-degree black belt who has cerebral palsy. But the Covington, Virginia man hasn't let the disability stand in his way. He may be the only disabled fourth-degree black belt in the world. The 46-year-old was diagnosed with CP at an early age and has had more than 30 operations. Back in the 70s, when Johnson was in school, there were no regulations integrating the disabled into so-called regular classrooms. And he says he was picked on a lot because of his disability.
When I was 10 on ABC Y World Sports, they had like a gentleman that was in a wheelchair. He was an amputee and was confronted by like three people or four people, and he dispatched them pretty quickly, and I said, well, I can do that.
Johnson began his search for a studio and instructor and started studying American freestyle karate in Salem, Virginia, more than 20 years ago. His instructor and close friend, Eddie Thomas, says many people wouldn't teach Johnson because of his disability.
I know from his perspective that was very disheartening, but from my perspective, a lot of them just didn't know what to do with him. Because, like, you know, on my end of it, I could see instructors that would know what to do with young, healthy people, but not with the elderly, not with overweight people, not with, you know, people that had special needs.
In 1983, Johnson and Thomas started working in private lessons, modifying the katas, or forms, for Johnson to learn using only his upper body.
I weaned him into the group class to where he simply did his alternative motions as opposed to what, if somebody else was kicking, he was working on joint locks or punching or elbow strikes or grappling kind of motions.
Johnson has also studied with Dan Inosanto, who was a student of the late Bruce Lee. And in addition to his fourth degree black belt in American freestyle karate, Johnson is an expert in the Filipino martial arts and is a certified Muay Thai boxing instructor. Even though he's confined to a wheelchair, Johnson says he has no trouble teaching someone how to kick.
Because I'm not so concerned how great I am. I want to make sure that my students are good, and I'm not so concerned how, like, oh, look at me, I can kick this high or I can kick that high or whatever else.
But there's more to the martial arts than just technique. Advanced black belts require knowledge of history and philosophy. What do Johnson's students think of their teacher?
He's an excellent teacher.
17-year-old Jonathan Aldridge is a new brown belt at Johnson Studio. He was also bullied as a child and looks up to his instructor as a role model.
He breaks things down to where it's so simple you can understand it. Even though he may not have the ability to kick, he taught me how to kick. And so I think that's pretty impressive.
Aldridge hopes to one day open his own karate studio in North or South Carolina. Some might call Johnson a role model, but Clay doesn't like that label.
I feel very detached when somebody calls me a role model or hero, because to me, I'm just a guy. I'm nobody extremely special. I just have a unique talent to be able to teach combat.
Yep. One, two.
For Only a Game, I'm Beverly Amsler in Roanoke, Virginia.
7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17.
You're listening to Only a Game. Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the National Football League, has done his best to move his corporation past the transgressions of the New England Patriots. He's fined Pats head coach Bill Belichick $500,000, fined the team an additional $250,000, and snatched away a first-round draft choice from the franchise as well. Matt Walsh, formerly employed by the Patriots as a video assistant, has done his best to keep the story of what he illegally did on behalf of his former employer in the news. After Goodell and Walsh met on Tuesday, the commissioner announced that what he'd learned from Walsh was, quote, consistent with what we disciplined the Patriots for last fall. In other words, move along. Nothing to see here. Walsh went directly from Commissioner Goodell's office to a meeting with Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter, who subsequently accused the commissioner of failing to conduct an objective investigation because of, quote, a conflict of interest arising, Specter said, because the commissioner didn't want the public to lose confidence in the integrity of the NFL. Senator Specter went on to characterize the commissioner's alleged investigation of the Patriots' trespasses as incomprehensible and an insult to the intelligence of people following the story. Matt Walsh subsequently told HBO's Andrea Kramer that Bill Belichick and the Patriots had knowingly violated the league's rules about videotaping opponents for years. As evidence, he claimed team officials told him how to avoid being caught while he was making the illegal tapes. You can't blame Roger Goodell for wanting people to believe that the so-called Spygate saga is no story at all. He's a businessman. He wants fans buying tickets, television packages, and team merchandise and discussing trades and draft picks, not wondering to what extent cheating helped the Patriots become one of the league's most successful franchises. You can't blame Arlen Specter for challenging the commissioner. He's a politician. He represents a state full of football fans who root for two of the teams that have allegedly been victimized by the conniving Pats. And you certainly can't blame Matt Walsh for not going away. There may be a book deal in this mess, or at least a reality TV show if he can keep the buzz buzzing. We have been party to the creation of a culture in which winning is profitable enough so that cheating is worth the risk, in which maintaining a league's image is more important than establishing its integrity, in which, for a politician, any publicity is good publicity, and in which the achievement of notoriety by an individual, no matter by what means, is a good career move. So blame us. Come spy with me. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Recognizing that an international soccer tournament would be a good deal less tasty without French fries, a.k.a. chips, the Swiss government has eased restrictions on the importation of potatoes to allow for the arrival of an additional 5,000 tons of potential fries before Euro 2008 begins on June 7th. A somewhat more troubling comestible issue involves the dwindling supplies of an especially beloved form of sausage following a European Union ban on the importation of the Brazilian cow's intestines traditionally used to encase the sausage. The intestines of cows from other countries would be entirely unsatisfactory because they, like the brand of soccer played in countries other than Brazil, are simply not sufficiently beautiful. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, eat your heart out, Ernest Lawrence there. Some real baseball poetry. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
It's Preakness Day, and when the race is over, will we all be thinking Triple Crown?
According to the people who get paid to invest in these animals, yes. Big Brown, the number seven horse, is going off at 1-2, which means basically a lot of people are going to make a lot of money betting place and show on this race. This is unbelievable. You could put something out there on wheels and not be this big a favorite.
The Court of Arbitration for Sport ruled this week that 21-year-old double amputee sprinter Oscar Pistorius may compete for a spot on South Africa's track and field team, which will compete in Beijing this year. Are you surprised that the CAS disagreed with the IAAF's claim that his prosthetic blades gave him an unfair advantage?
First of all, the Court of Arbitration for Sport sounds like those guys in the silver suits in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure sitting up on the wall. Be excellent to each other. I'm not surprised when one group of initials overrules another group of initials. Mm-hmm. I'm happy for Mr. Pistorius. I hope he gets to run. It's an intriguing question to talk about in terms of going forward down through the following century in sports. But am I surprised that one group of overfed stuffed shirts overruled another group of overfed stuffed shirts? No.
One of my favorite NBA playoff moments occurred on Monday night, Charlie, and I wish it could have happened the previous day, because what could be more appropriate for Mother's Day than a mom coming to the defense of her child?
Gloria James, LeBron's mom, took offense at Paul Pierce's hard foul of her lad and got up and started wagging his finger in the face like it was a Campbell's Soup commercial or something. Everybody took it in great good spirits, which is a good thing. And Paul Pierce, to his credit, said his mom would probably have done the same thing. I hope this is not a trend, though, because I really don't want, like,
you battling
know,
moms.
The essential dynamic of Little League or kiddie soccer coming to the professional sports, because, frankly, we've had enough of that.
Among the men who don't hold the record for number of NBA playoff games participated in are Bill Russell, Magic Johnson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Michael Jordan. Can you tell me who grabbed that title like a ripe rebound this week?
Robert Horry, big shot Robert Horry, now playing for the Spurs, appeared in Game 5 against New Orleans and went by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who had the previous record with 237. This was his 238th playoff game. He's contributed mightily to a bunch of different champions. He's had a very interesting, profitable, and very honorable career.
The Knicks will have a new coach next season. We knew that. But the coach will be Mike D'Antoni. Surprised?
Yes, because I didn't know if they were going to find anyone to spend an entire year hitting himself in the head with a mallet, but apparently they did. Mike D'Antoni's a good hire for them. Their personnel is not entirely terrible. He plays a very entertaining brand of ball. He'll bring that to Madison Square Garden. If they wanted to clear the air on everything, this is as good as what's going to happen to him.
David Stern wants to turn back the clock and present NBA games that are less dependent on pyrotechnic explosions and gimmicks. Is there anything to say here beyond good luck stuffing that particular genie back into that particular bottle?
I was about to say, there's David Stern standing at the front door of the barn waving forlornly as the horse goes over the horizon. This is your league, dude. This is what it was coming to. And believe me, somewhere in Connecticut, Vince McMahon is laughing his steroid-riddled head off at the NBA. Fuss over this.
On Tuesday, Annika Sorenstam, the LPGA Golfer of the Year, a record 8 times, announced that she would retire at the end of the current season. The following day, Justine Henin, the number one female tennis player in the world, announced her retirement beginning immediately. That was a little thoughtless of Ms. Henin, don't you think?
It was an interesting couple of days, because both of these, now I freely admit I don't follow either sport as closely as I once did, but both of these came as something of a surprise to me, basically because both of them are retiring on the grounds of, I want to do something else with my life, and I don't want to do this anymore. Justine Henin is 25.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the equivalent of Jim Brown walking away. Now, granted, if both of these athletes were, boxers, we wouldn't believe either one of them as far as we could throw Louis Armstrong Stadium. But the fact is, if these people retire and stay retired, these are two people who are walking away from the top of their sports just because they want to do something else. And we don't see that very often.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania talked to former New England Patriots video assistant Matt Walsh on the same day regarding what Walsh had done on behalf of the New England Patriots for 2 years. How could they have come to such different conclusions?
Because Roger Goodell runs the NFL and wants this whole mess to go away, and because Arlen Specter is a nudge and wants this thing kept alive for reasons known only to him. But I'll tell you what, watching his involvement in this case, I am now totally convinced that not only did Lee Harvey Oswald not shoot John Kennedy, but that he was in Bimini on November 22nd, 1963. I wouldn't believe anything Arlen Specter said right now.
Hall of Famer Goose Gossage said this week that New York Yankees reliever Jabba Chamberlain should stop celebrating when he strikes guys out at the risk of being labeled an old fud. Do you agree, Charlie?
I think not only should Mr. Chamberlain stop doing this, he should get off Rich Gossage's lawn! Hey, you know,
is Rich Gossage that old?
I don't think so. He's not older than me, I don't think.
Old enough to be worried about his lawn.
I know, we're going to have so much of this down through the years. It's time to stop worrying about these arguments. Chamberlain will do what he wants to do, and Rich Gossage is just going to have to put up with it.
Ready for a riddle?
Yes.
All right. When is a team sport not a team sport?
When Bonnie Richardson of Rochelle High School in Texas wins the 1A state team championship all by herself.
She's the only person on the team.
Yeah, this is a Babe Zaharias moment, as I recall. Yeah. He used to do this all the time. This is one of the reasons why God made Texas, so we would have sports stories like this. Good for you, Bonnie.
Charlie Pierce, whose favorite Girl Scout cookie is the shortbread, I think, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game, and I hope I got that right. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If you perchance have a predilection, a penchant, or even a passion for podcasts, please proceed to onlyagame.org and press podcast. Sort of Gone, Sarah Freely's new collection of poems, most of which are set in baseball, begins in the middle. It begins, in fact, with a poem titled No Hitter, Fifth Inning. Too early to hope, she writes, as if just hoping could jinx the process of creating something beautiful. Sarah Freely joins me now from the studios of WXXI in Rochester, New York. Sarah, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
The central figure in Sort of Gone is Al Stepanski, a pitcher who lives the dream of making it to the major leagues and then inevitably falls at least as far as he has risen. But this book takes on a far different tone than the traditional literary tales of fathers and sons and baseball. When Al gets signed by a scout, he and his family get a parade in Al's hometown. Maybe you could read the second part of the poem titled Bonus Baby just to give us a sense of that tone.
Sure. Afterward, Al's paraded through the neighborhood, perched on a bullet-colored convertible borrowed from Pulaski's lot, bookended between his parents who wave like new Miss Americas to three people drinking from paper bags in front of Fred and Eddie's, to the VFW where Al shakes hands with his uncles, hugs his aunts who cry and bury his head between the boulders of their breasts. Al's father sips a ginger ale, wishing he could sweeten it with a nip of whiskey, while Al's mother arranges furniture in the living room of the dream house Al will buy her.
There is a saying about athletes that suggests that they die twice, the first death coming when their careers end. But that possibility isn't something an athlete can allow himself or herself to think about. Is that the circumstance you had in mind with the title poem, Sort of Gone?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I think not just that poem, but many of the poems throughout this book, I had that sense of attending, as a sports writer, attending press conferences where a player would announce his retirement. I remember Jim Palmer, somebody who had a career already, pretty promising broadcasting career ahead of him. And yet, it was terribly hard for him. I think he broke down in the middle and had to walk off the podium where they had him. And I thought, here's this person who has everything in the world. And they had to basically rip the shirt from his back, or that's what it seemed like. Mm. And he's not the only one. There have been, I think, many of those.
There is a moment, of course, in Al Stepanski's own retirement press conference where he says, hey, thanks a lot. I guess now I'll have time to grow flowers or something.
Roses.
Yeah, grow roses or something. And it's it is a very powerful and painful moment, I think.
Thank you. That was a sestina. There's two sestinas in there. There's a couple of sonnets. There's a pantom, just because I wanted to prove that, even though it's baseball poetry, I can still attempt to write in form. Mm. And that just kind of fell into that. A friend of mine who is a poet once said, a sestina is great for someone, a speaker who has, a rant maybe, or they keep coming back to something. The other poem that is a sestina is Groupie. There's a formula for it. It's almost like a recipe, and nobody memorizes it, I don't think. But I wrote the first sestina, I remember. I wrote Groupie. It was 4 days before my mother died in 1999, and it was important for me to keep writing, but it was hard to create, so I felt as if a form, particularly a form where you knew where the line was going to end, it was almost like a math problem in words. So I worked with that, and there was some great comfort in the sort of predictability and non-predictability of it. I can't, I can't give you, but it felt good. It just felt good. And, then I wrote the second one years later, but...
Well, you know, since you have come back to talk a little bit about Groupie, I wonder if you might read that poem on page 35.
It's got some naughty words in it. Should I read it anyway?
Well, that's what bleeps are for.
Great. I hang around with ballplayers because I love baseball, the game, the guys. Ask the other girls, any of them. They'll tell you the same thing. We do it for love, not sex. Sure, the wives hate us. What sluts, they whisper, grab onto their men. But hey, they can't watch them 24 hours a day. They would if they could, the wives, watch them all day, I mean, chain them to their need like a dog. What kind of love is that, I ask you? They don't understand their men at all, which is why a ball player spends time with a girl like me, someone he can talk to. But you can't tell the wives that. They look at me like I'm not a person, but a thing to ignore or avoid, like on a sidewalk, something dirty, and I'm not. Last week, on San Diego Chicken Day, the chicken picked me to dance. Me, not one of the wives, even though they're prettier than I am, and God knows I love to dance. I showed off my moves, got people yelling, "You go, girl," shook my butt, shimmied my boobs. I got the men going a little crazy, whistling and stomping their feet. Some man in the front row stood up, threw money at me. Nothing big, but hey, it was a joke, because I'm not the kind of girl who does it for money. Some whore who 20 men a day. I need a guy to tell me I'm beautiful. Tell me he loves my red toenails. Love how I listen to him. How he wishes his wife were more like me. Just once, I'd like to say to the wives when they give me the evil eye, why don't you ask your old man where he really was yesterday when he went out for cigarettes? Loving me, that's where. Three times. I'd tell her all the things he said to me, how we're going to be together someday when he gets to the show. How he should have married a girl like me instead of the prom queen from high school, the girl voted most likely to succeed, the girl who's now the wife who won't listen when he tries to tell her about the bad day he had at the ballpark. As long as there's women like that, men will need someone like me to talk to, give him the things he's not getting at home, pamper him a little. That's true love, isn't it? A girl who's been around as much as I have knows what a man wants, and it's not a wife who's on him for every little thing he does. So watch it, sister, or someday he'll be mine to love. Have you written a Sestina?
I haven't. The odd sonnet, but mostly, you know, doggerel and faux haiku.
Oh, there's several haiku. Postcard is a haiku.
That's right.
And then Somanka is, you know, like the tanka, the two tankas with the 5-7-5-7-7 syllables.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of, you know, like everything else in this book, I sort of didn't play by the rules there, because a Somanka is really, you know, like a declaration of love that is sent out and then is answered. And the Somanka here, it's Al writing a postcard to his father. I'm writing this from Houston, 14 days now, out of underwear. San Fran is really something. Who wouldn't leave their heart there? And then the answer is a telegram. Regret to inform you, your mom passed on Tuesday. Stop. Buried today. Stop. No need to return home. Stop. Best to stay where you are. He and his father had a difficult relationship.
Yes, yes. At the end of the collection of poems, there are two especially memorable images, I think. One occurs at the end of a beer league softball game when you give us, quote, "the arc of the white ball, a pearl in the jewel box of twilight sky." And in the other, you give us Al remembering the roar of the crowd, and you write, "Oh, listen to how he is loved." Are these images meant to help soften the blow of Al's decline?
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. That's a nice way to look at it, and I'm going to appropriate that. It's gone, it's over, it's done with, but he still has the memories. The last poem, as a matter of fact, Nightcap, is inspired by something real that happened in Philadelphia. A pitcher who was retired from the Phillies used to live in a neighborhood where I lived, and he would invite people over to his place after the bar closed so they could raid his liquor cabinet, which was quite extensive and very impressive. And one night, I think, while everybody was, you know, like getting into the liquor and having fun, I looked over, and there he was sitting in front of the television watching tapes of himself, all by himself, watching tapes of himself pitching. And most of the people in the room were really too young, I think, to remember when he pitched and probably how, you know, like great he was and how famous. They were more interested in the free liquor, but there he was with this evidence in front of him that he was someone. You know, the famous Joe DiMaggio line that I just had to include when Marilyn Monroe comes back from entertaining the troops and she said, "Oh, Joe, you've never heard such applause." He says, "Yes, I have." Three saddest words in the English language, "Yes, I have."
Sarah Freely is the author of Sort of Gone, published by Turning Point Books. She joined me from the studios of WXXI in Rochester, New York. Sarah, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Jim Doyle, Kirk Carapeza, and Dave Slaberski at WXXI in Rochester, New York. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Sort of Gone author Sarah Freely, who shares a spicy detail from one of her poems. And that's why those signs on the outfield wall read, "Nope." I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.